People have long debated the question, what is happiness and what does money have to do with it? In recent years, scientists have tried to help us understand what happiness is and how we can cultivate it in our lives and what it has to do with our bank accounts and the clothes in our closet. Money and happiness on this edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is here to break it down. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Kevin, welcome back.
Hello, Kate.
And if you have a personal money question of your own, join in at 800-642-1234. You can also email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org, post your question on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kevin, a recent study shows how to spend your way to happiness. What is this all about?
Yeah, it might offer some hints for the holiday season, too. According to the journal PNAS, that, of course, Kate, as you well know and are probably a subscriber to, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. Ashley Willens, who is an assistant professor at Harvard University, she worked with people at the University of British Columbia and in two institutions in the Netherlands. And they put together a total of seven surveys of 6,000 respondents over four countries. And they basically wanted to ask these people, do you pay people to perform tasks for you? And these would be very basic, mundane tasks that, like cooking, shopping, cleaning, etc.
So what did they find out?
They found out that, not so shockingly, those who did pay people were happier than the people who did those things themselves. But what they found that was very interesting is they found that people who paid people to do those tasks got more enjoyment out of that money spent than people who bought something with the same dollar amount. They gave people $40 to buy a thing, and then they also gave them $40 to have a service performed for them. And then they said, how happy do you feel after you purchase this thing? And how happy do you feel after you had the service performed? And it didn't matter across income, across hours worked, across wealth, across age, marital status, single, happily married, unhappily married, whatever, whether they had children or not. To a person, they reported that when they paid for the service, they had higher levels of satisfaction and happiness than when they bought a thing.
So do you agree with the results?
Yes, I do. Working people who generally have more money than time, and then retired people who are less likely to have either the physical capability to do some of these things, or they're just so sick of doing them every single day or every single week over the last 40 or 50 years. They don't like doing the task, or they aren't good at it. They are better spending their time doing something that they enjoy. If they're working, and especially if they get paid by the hour, they're better off working for the money and paying someone else to do it rather than doing something that they don't enjoy doing.
Then why don't more of us pay others to carry the load on things that we don't want to do?
Well, why would you? Let me ask you, what are the things that stop you from doing that? Because I know there's probably some things that you don't like doing that that you would prefer someone else do, correct?
Oh, of course, yes.
Okay, what's stopping you?
Well, money, for one.
Okay, good. That's what would be most of it. Most of us don't feel like we either have the money to pay someone else to do it or we just don't want to do it. But it's also that virtue of self-sufficiency. You know, I'm a big believer in the philosophy of I'm going to do what I do really well, and then I'm hopefully going to earn enough money to pay other people to do things that I don't like to do and I don't like to do at all. And that manifested itself in my relationship with my wife in several different areas, but one of which was I hate mowing the lawn. And so I'm very happy to pay someone else to mow the lawn. And my wife, who comes from a hardworking background, she said, well, I understand that. And yes, we can afford to pay someone 20 or 30 bucks to mow the lawn, but I don't want our kids to see us paying someone else to do that. And I just said, yeah, I get that, but it makes no sense for me to do a bad job at it, risk my life and limb for someone who is willing to take the money. And quite frankly, when you pay someone to do a service at an agreed upon price, you are doing a favor for that person because they are out to earn money. They are obviously willing to do this, and they're obviously willing to accept the money for the job. So you're really doing them a favor as well by giving them money to perform that service.
So how does this parlay to the holiday gift-giving season we're in?
Yeah. Well, first of all, most of us can say we probably have enough stuff. We have more stuff than we could possibly need and fit in our homes. And, You know, even when we don't have some certain things or stuff, we go out and buy it for ourselves. So what we don't have usually is enough time, and we don't have enough time, especially with people who want to spend time with us or need to spend time with us or with whom we want to spend time. And so later on in the show, during the Shop Around segment, we're going to talk about some gifts that aren't stuff but can offer more time and more help to people. And so pay attention and hang in for the next 20 minutes here.
And speaking of gift giving and saving time, next week we have a very special edition of On Your Money.
Yes, this will be the first membership drive, Kate, that you have experienced with On Your Money. Is that correct?
That is. Yeah, I've been a bystander, but not full-fledged in on it.
All right. Well, this will be a joy to have you along with it. During the On Your Money membership drive, if you pledge at any dollar amount whatsoever, you will receive a copy of the On Your Money mini money booklet, one of our most popular ones ever, called 15 Ways to Fight Fraud. Lots of tips that you can use to protect your identity, protect yourself from hacking, watch out for people dipping into your internet service, getting into your electronic files, 15 ways to fight fraud, updated for all of the scandals that have come out with the Equifax hack, some of the Anthem health insurance hack that came through where hundreds of millions of people had their identities exposed online. And if you pledge any dollar amount whatsoever on Tuesday at 8 a.m. or during the repeat on Saturday at noon, you will get your copy, whether it's $1 or $100. And because it's a relatively low-cost way to pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio and still get a premium gift, it also makes a nice gift for the holidays.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And you are with us on this edition of On Your Money. You can join in the conversation if you have a question for Kevin. Ask away at 800-642-1234. You can send your money question via email at onyourmoney@wpr.org or post it on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Kevin, here's an email from Tiffany who says, I have about $65,000 in student loans and I'm just finishing up my master's degree. I'm anticipating working for a public or private university making between $50,000 to $60,000 a year. Can I take advantage of the public service loan forgiveness program? Can I count on that loan forgiveness after 10 years of on-time monthly payments? And thank you for the wonderful show. What do you say, Kevin?
Well, I say, first of all, Kate, as you know, we're a lot more likely to take these questions if they include false praise. So Tiffany's obviously very well-educated, but obviously very savvy because she included false praise right at the end of the question. Good work, Tiffany. Let's start with the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. These are for people who have taken out direct federal loans. And how it works is if you work in a qualifying occupation for a qualifying employer, you still have to make payments on those loans for 10 years, the minimum amount due. But after 10 years of making those payments, if you've worked for that time during for the qualifying employer, whatever's remaining on the balance is forgiven. And about 600,000 people or so have qualified so far, but about 4 million people may have qualified for this according to the government statistics, but aren't aware yet that they could take advantage of this program.
So will Tiffany qualify?
It depends on her employer. The qualifying employers are generally government organizations, nonprofits, 501c3s. Could be certain law enforcement agencies, people in the military, library workers, public health workers all may qualify as well. So what she should do is check with these employers and see if it lists, see if the employers meet the criteria. And we'll have a link to the website at onyourmoney.com, but you can go to studentaid.gov, I think it is, that has all the links for the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. And even if she doesn't qualify for this, as long as the loans are federal loans, and her income is low enough, she may still qualify for an income-based repayment program. And how that works is that if your income is low enough and you have federal student loans, you can lower the amount that's required to meet the minimum payment requirements. And after several years of meeting those minimum requirements, whatever's left over from the balance is forgiven. And you can get more information on that at IBRinfo.org. That's IBRinfo.org. And again, that'll be up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Can she be confident that if she qualifies to enter the public student loan forgiveness program now, that it will still be around and in place in 10 years from now?
That is the $64 question, because there are some legislative changes afoot that may alter that forgiveness program. The Department of Education has said in recent court filings that there is no guarantee that the forgiveness will be granted upon it. And that's kind of hard for people to deal with, because we're talking about something that's 10 years down the road and a lot can change. But what this program actually was put into place about 10 years ago. So there really haven't been a whole lot of loans forgiven, because only 10 years have elapsed and we're just seeing the first wave of it right now. Keep in mind, if you have student loans that are forgiven, generally the amount will be taxable as income. And it's going to be a relatively small amount. It's probably not going to be all of your payment, because you will have made some principal payments over the 10-year time period, hopefully. So don't take a job just because the employer offers loan forgiveness. You might be better off taking one that pays a higher salary or that you might like more, and then just making the payments as required for it. And then keep some savings aside just in case somewhere down the road, either you don't want to have that loan balance outstanding, or the government says, I'm really sorry, but you're going to have to keep paying this off. So hope for the best, but expect the worst.
You are with us for On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is addressing your money questions. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. There's a line for you. You can join in with your personal finance question at 800-642-1234. What money question is on your mind? You can ask away, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll return in just a bit.
You're a rich girl, and you're gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. Say money, money won't get you too far, get you too far.
As the ball drops this New Year's Eve, you can raise a glass to the Roth IRA. January 1 marks the 20th anniversary of this retirement account. The Roth IRA was established by the Taxpayer Relief Act of 1997 and named for its chief legislative sponsor. That was Senator William Roth of Delaware. And in the past couple decades, Roths have grown to hold more than $660 billion in assets. We'll be getting to the IRA question later this hour. Speaking of assets, it is On Your Money, and Kevin McKinley is with us. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in. There's a line for you for your personal finance question for Kevin at 800-642-1234. You can also send that question in an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or post it to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Digging into the mailbag, Sandra in Madison emails, Kevin, you're the greatest guest to ever appear on Wisconsin Public Radio, way better than anyone else. I give you an A++++. I would like to refinance my mortgage and go with my awesome credit union, Sandra says, but it is unclear whether I have enough equity. Based on the tax assessment, I come up short. They said if the property were appraised high enough, they could possibly do it, but I would have to put down a $400 deposit, which of course I might not get back. My current mortgage is 6.375%. I'm hoping to take $100 or $150 off my mortgage payment. I'm thinking of going to the website lendingtree.com. Any caveats or other suggestions?
Wait, just for my own satisfaction, how many A's plus plus was it?
There are several pluses
plus key down for a long time. Good for you, Sandra. Okay. I'm a big fan of trying to refinance your mortgage, especially when you're paying 6.375%. That's a very high interest rate. It reflects maybe you took the mortgage out a long time ago, or when you took it out, you may not have been in a strong enough financial position to get a lower interest rate. So definitely look at refinancing it. The good and the bad news is the appraisal won't be based on the tax assessment. It's going to be based on an appraisal conducted by an appraiser hired by the lending institution. That's what the $400 that you're being charged, that's what that pays for, is the appraiser to go and look at it and and estimate what he or she thinks the house is worth. Then the bank will come back and say, can we refinance that or not? And sometimes even after they, if she does get a high enough appraisal, that it makes sense to refinance, even when she goes back in to do it, there could be points and other expenses, closing costs. The closing costs usually run about $2,000 to $3,000 maybe for a full brand new 30-year mortgage refinance at the most. Anything more than that is just points that she's that are being used to buy down the interest rate of the loan and are expenses she has to consider before she refinances. I would invest the money at this time because there's a good chance that appraisals may be higher now than for sure they've been in the last several years or maybe in the next several years, and lenders may be friendlier now than they have been in the last several years or the next several years. And interest rates are lower now than they may be in the future. So I'd really like, Sandra, you to go ahead, invest that $400 to get the new appraisal and see what the lender says. And if you don't like what that lender says, go to another one and see if you can get a mortgage from that particular person. What you want to try to do, though, is definitely lower that interest rate down somewhere around 4%. Or so. Try to keep a 30-year fixed rate mortgage so you can still afford the payments, but you can always pay it off early if your situation allows you to do that or it makes sense financially to do that. And in terms of LendingTree, yeah, you might as well try that. You know, LendingTree is kind of a place where they aggregate a bunch of lenders who you put in the application for a loan. The lenders take a look at your situation, then they spit back what the terms will be to you, and then you don't have to take one of those loans, but it would be something I would do, especially after you were turned down from your original mortgage. The only thing that might hurt a little bit is when you start applying for these mortgages with all these different lenders, you want to do it in a very short period of time, like a window of maybe a month or so, because it will affect your credit rating whenever you do apply for the mortgage, but you will have, once the credit bureaus see that you're not constantly applying for new loans over several months, it was just while you were obviously looking at refinancing, it won't take long for that
to bounce back.
Yeah, for that to bounce back. You're right, Kate. And it will it won't damage it too much anyway, maybe 10 or 20 points in the first place. Lenders understand that when you apply for, you know, you have to apply for a loan, and when you apply for one, it can hurt your credit rating somewhat, but not enough to keep you from getting the loan. But the only way you can find out is to actually ask the lender.
And Kevin, you're walking a fine line between going down that refinancing of a mortgage path, and what if you're not staying in that home for longevity? Like, what is that line where you say, is this worth it to spend this money versus if you know you're going to be selling that home?
Yeah, that's actually a great question, because what you can do is you can divide out the total cost of getting the mortgage. So let's say between the application, between the closing costs, et cetera, let's say it's $4,000, and you're going to save yourself, let's say $200 on the per month on the mortgage payment by getting the refinance. Well, to make up that difference, you probably have to stay in the home on that mortgage for 20 months. 20 months of $200 per month savings equals $4,000. So that's an easy way to figure out if it's worth it. Now, most people, when they say they're going to move, they usually don't move as quickly as they want to or as they think they're going to. So it usually does make sense to refinance, but that's a good component of the decision-making process to bring up.
Let's go to Rich, who joins us from Huntley, Illinois. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I am getting ready to sell out my home, and I have a bunch of my money is all tied up in IRAs, and I went to my bank to get them to help me with a financial plan, and they failed. And I'm wondering, would I be better off going to a private financial advisor to get my lifestyle and my funds organized?
Yeah, do you want them organized for investing, Richard, or is it more about, you know, like getting your estate kind of set up so that if something happens to you, the details are taken care of?
Well, it's mostly mostly it's going on to living for the rest of my life with the funds I have and my investment in my home, and I need to know who could help me the best to organize all that.
Yeah, your experience with the bank is not uncommon. Most banks, if they do have a financial person in their organization, oftentimes that person is really more of a salesperson than a consultant. Very rarely are they a typical financial planner where they'll help you address all these different issues. Usually they just say, well, we're going to give us your money, whether it's in your IRA or whatever. We'll put it in some mutual funds and we'll check back in 6 months or something. It sounds like you want more comprehensive planning. And if that's the case, there are a few different places you can go. to look for a fee-based financial planner in a specific geographic area. One of them is you can look at the CFP's website, Certified Financial Planning website, and that's letsmakeaplan.org. And then you can go to NAPFA, N-A-P-F-A.org. And there's another one out there for the Financial Planning Association. We talked about it a couple weeks ago, but we'll put links to all three of those up, Rich, at our website, onyourmoney.com, so you can find it. And just to reiterate something we talked about last week, when we have all these links that we talk about on the show, they eventually will be up at onyourmoney.com. The way that you find them is to look at the most recent show, whatever the most recent radio show is. That will have not only a link to a download of Wisconsin Public Radio, so if you want to listen to the show and suffer through it one more time, you can, but it also will have all the websites that we talk. So go to onyourmoney.com and then look for the link usually under journals, and it will have links to all of our shows, and then each one of those shows will also have links to all of the websites that we mentioned.
Rich, thanks so much for calling in. And we have open lines right now. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, he can take it at 800-642-1234. Do you have a pressing money question that's been on your mind? Perhaps you've been thinking about it at night and maybe avoiding sleep. Run it by Kevin, 800-642-1234. You can also send it via email to onyourmoney@wpr.org, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. With just a few weeks left until December 31st, we have some year-end money moves we should consider. What's on tap this week, Kevin?
Several steps over the last few weeks of the year. We've talked about capital gains. We've talked about donor advised funds. And today we're going to talk about converting IRAs to Roth IRAs. To have the conversion count in the 2017 tax year, you have to complete the conversion before the end of the year. December 31st is the last day. And anything that you convert from an IRA to a Roth IRA will be added to your taxable income, and it may be subject to income taxes.
So why would one pay taxes now that they don't have to?
Right. Don't we just want to kick that tax can
down the road?
Yeah. Right. Hopefully we'll die before those taxes will finally come due. No. What you want to do is you want to convert it now, hopefully when the tax rate will be lower than what it would be in the future when you pull it out. Plus, Roth IRAs, unlike IRAs, Roth IRAs have no required minimum distribution date while you're alive, so you never technically have to take the money out while you're alive. And under today's laws, if you pull money out of a Roth IRA and you're collecting Social Security, the dollars you pull out of the Roth IRA will not make the Social Security more likely to be taxable. Social Security is technically tax-free, but then there's a formula you have to use that then determines, it's kind of a means testing based on your income, and Roth IRA distributions are one of the few components of income that do not make Social Security taxable.
So is there a good way to know how much to convert?
For most people, if you think you can do it and still stay in the 15% federal income tax bracket, it's probably a good idea to do it, because most people are going to be at least at that bracket. Some people may be higher in the future. And where the 15% federal income tax bracket basically shakes out is usually about $50,000 of gross income for a single filer and about $100,000 for married couples who file jointly. And the line's actually determined on what the figure on line 43 says. And then H&R Block has a tax estimator that you can use. You can punch in all of your information of what you think. You don't have to give your name. You don't have to pay anything for it. And that'll let you know about what your taxable income will be for 2017. And then you can use that to say, okay, if I go back in and let's take $20,000, let's say, and add that into the IRA withdrawal amount, how might that affect my taxes? And again, we'll have a link to the HR Block tax estimator calculator at onyourmoney.com later on today.
But still, we won't know what our 2017 taxes will be until after the year is over. So what about that?
Yeah, we're still guessing. And so the cool thing about Roth IRA conversions, converting money from IRAs to Roth IRAs, is that you have to make the conversion by December 31st of the year in question. But if you go back in and then do your taxes or have someone else do your taxes for you, and you find out that, oh, shoot, once all the real numbers got in there, I will be taxed at a higher rate on this than I would otherwise wish. You can do what's called a recharacterization. That's basically a do-over. You can wipe out the conversion for it and pretend like it didn't happen, or you can move it to 2018 if you want to do it. And the deadline to do that recharacterization is April 15th or October 15th of the following year if you get an extension. Also, as it comes to the converting from IRAs to Roth IRAs, if you are under 59.5, be careful on the taxes, because if you don't have money withheld for it right now and don't pay the taxes from it, there might be a small penalty. You might have to start filing quarterly estimates. And if you use the withholding from the conversion to pay the taxes, you may then owe taxes plus a penalty on that dollar amount. So what you want to do is have the converted amount from the IRA to Roth IRA. Again, if you're under 59.5, have that done, but then pay the taxes out of a checking account or something like that, because otherwise the taxes that are withheld don't qualify as a qualified distribution from the IRA.
Well, we had a listener who emailed saying, I'm 62 with a 401k. Would it be best for me to transfer it into a Roth IRA? If so, is now a good time of the year to make this change? You've been addressing this. And at what age do I have to start making withdrawals?
Well, yeah, it can be a good time. Again, it depends on the tax bracket.
Okay.
And the nice thing about being over 59.5 is you can just have the taxes withheld from the converted amount without having to worry about all those penalties I just referred to.
Okay.
And so if you want to make the conversion, contact the financial services firm, let them know what you want to do. And you want to get going on that now, because it usually takes a week or two to get all the paperwork back and forth. And you've only got 4 weeks to get it done. So get that done now. And then in terms of the required minimum distribution, no. While you're alive, there are no required minimum distributions from a Roth IRA. If there is a balance in the Roth IRA after you pass away, usually your heirs have to start taking it out, but it's only on their life expectancy. So it's usually, if a 40-year-old inherits a Roth IRA, it's usually a very small dollar amount that they have to take out each year. And whatever they do have to take out will be tax-free.
Let's go to Erica, who joins us in Middleton. Hi, Erica.
Hi, my husband is looking to change careers and doing a boot camp program, and I'm just trying to figure out how best to pay for that. We have some savings, but it wouldn't cover the entire cost. He wants to take out a loan for the whole thing, but I'd like to pay at least some of it in savings. So what would you suggest?
Erica, is it actual boot camp? Because I'm pretty sure you don't have to pay to join the military.
No, it is not an actual boot camp.
Ah, okay. So what is the topic that he's looking to become quickly adept at?
It's related to software development.
Sure. Like he's going to learn to code, basically, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. So I'm sorry. Go back to it again. You're trying to figure out how to pay for this, right?
Right, yeah. It's about $15,000. And, I mean, we could cover maybe a chunk of that.
Okay.
I think he wants to kind of just take out a loan, make sure we don't have to worry about anything. But I like the idea of not, taking out a huge loan and paying at least some of it up front.
Right. Do you trust yourselves, Erica, so that if, let's just say, you didn't use cash for it, would you say, I know us well enough to know that, especially with the holidays coming up or whatever, we'll burn through that and then we'll still have the loan outstanding? Because if we apply it towards the cost of the boot camp, then I know where it's gone, it's done for, and we've got a lock on the cookie jar, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I trust that we'll use it for the boot camp. I guess the other concern is just about living costs, since we'll be on one income.
Right.
But I think that we would do our best to make sure that we're using it for what it's intended to be used for.
Okay. Have you talked with any place that might lend you money for this?
No, I know that the place has lenders. I mean, mm-hmm. We haven't got to that point yet, but I think, we're going to have to. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You have a relationship, I'm guessing, Erica, with like a bank or a credit union, right?
Yeah.
Go there first before you talk to any other lenders. And they might offer you some kind of loan. They might offer you just a regular consumer loan. Are you homeowners or not?
No.
Okay. They still might offer you some kind of consumer loan. And I'm guessing the interest rates and the approval process are probably going to be at least as favorable as the lenders that the boot camp sponsor has set up for you. So go to the credit union or bank first, see what they say, and don't put down any more towards the Boot Camp, Erica, than you absolutely have to, especially if you have a concern about living on just one income while he's not only learning how to do this, but he's not just going to walk out of there and get a job, right? It's going to take a while to show those skills to prospective employers. So you want to have as much savings on hand as possible. And yes, that means you're going to have to pay a little bit of interest on the loan, but I'd rather have you pay a little bit of interest and just make the minimum payments on the loan, extend the loan out as far as you possibly can. Like if they say, well, do you want a 3-year loan or a 5-year loan? Take the 5-year loan, because usually you can pay it off earlier with no penalty if you want to. But for the time being, the monthly payment will be lower, and therefore it'll be easier for you to keep your heads above water and then just draw from the savings month to month to pay down the loan rather than applying the savings towards the actual course. So usually, Erica, we have a rule on your money. When spouses or partners call in for a money issue on which they're having some conflict, we usually just award the correct answer as being whoever called in. In your case, I'm really sorry, but your husband is correct on this. I'd want you to put down as little as possible, but then keep that savings set aside so that it's there to not only make the loan payments, but also pay for your other living expenses.
Erica, thanks for calling in. Good luck. Let's go to Logan, who joins us in Madison. Hi, Logan.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, yeah. I left a job in May of this year, and I only worked there for a few months, but I had a couple $1,000s that were taken out in taxes, and I was just wondering if there's any way I could get that back or do anything to get that back before the tax season next year.
Yeah, if your employer files for it, Logan, there's such a thing called W-2 early access, and Google that, and I'll put a link up to it on yourmoneynot.com too. But if you go to W-2 early access and your employer has already put the information up, you can usually get it more quickly. And you can also contact, have you contacted the employer just to see if it's possible to get that information directly from them?
No, I have not. I was actually going to go today and do that. But
okay, yeah, call them and just say, hey, I want this information. Can you get it to me? If not, Google W-2 Early Access, and there should be information on a program that you can use to find it that way.
Logan, thanks for the question. You are listening to On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is tackling your personal money questions. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. You can ask your money question to Kevin at 800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Post that question to the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back in just a moment.
On the 11th day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 11 pipers piping
and lords a-leaping.
How do you ditch the consumer gift-giving trend without feeling downright stingy? Are you trying to avoid sweaters, ties, jewelry, plastic toys that break? We're thinking through the beauty of non-material gift giving on this edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is here. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. If you have a pressing money question, there's still time to get in at 800-642-1234. You can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're just a few weeks away from the holiday gift-giving season, and you might want to rethink what's on your shopping list. Why is that, Kevin?
Well, part of it is age, part of it is life situation, but every holiday season, I love getting together with people, most of those people anyway, and I look at all the stuff that we buy for things, and people buy for our kids, and we buy for our kids, and I realize just what a waste a lot of it is. And, you know, when you're looking at buying a particular item or things, you know, first of all, you have to have it shipped to you or shipped to the other person. And then, you know, hopefully the person likes it. But if not, they're stuck with this new item. And they have to either return it, box it up, ship it, return it to the store. They have to make sure that they have a receipt for it, or they have to give it away, or they have to throw it away. And then that just goes in the landfill, and it's just more stuff. So I'm on a personal mission here to reduce the amount of stuff that we give during the holiday season and instead have less waste and hassle and more enjoyment by what we exchange with people if it does indeed have some tangible value.
But couldn't gift cards meet the criteria?
Yes, I'm not going to take all the credit for gift cards becoming a very popular gift, but there are going to be about $46 billion of gift cards given at least this year. That's about $400 per household. It's very practical. If you are giving a gift card, try to make it from the most general or ubiquitous store or provider you possibly can, because if it comes from that little candle shop that's just, you know, in one particular town, it's probably not going to be used. It's great to support local businesses, et cetera, but you might be better off just, you know, trying to find, give them a cash gift card or something that that they can use instead.
But can you make it more personal?
Yeah, I'd take a look at maybe giving something that might have an ongoing reminder of the gift. That might be like a membership. You can go to get one at Costco or Walmart or something for someone for, you know, $50 or whatever, and that might save them some money, provide some services to the people as well that they can use year-round. You could buy them an Amazon Prime membership where they could not only get access to lots of different media but save on shipping. You might get a food co-op local one if you know that the people shop at one there, pay for the food co-op membership, or even something as silly as like club dues to a particular organization that people like, or even AARP, you know, just make a membership for them there and say, hey, here's a membership. It's a good organization. I like what they do, and you might save some money in the process as well. You might also look at subscriptions to such things as like online newspapers. Maybe someone who's a big fan of the New York Times but doesn't like paying for the digital access, buy them a subscription to that, and they can. It doesn't have to be for the entire year. Just find one within a few months for your budget. Could be other online sites. If they're big sports fans, they might like a paid site like ESPN that has a like an insider subscription that you can get and also provides a magazine as well, or even some of the music sites like Spotify that have premium services. People, you know, listen to those things all the time when they're not listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and they enjoy not having to pay for it. And finally, we've talked in the last couple of weeks about streaming services. You know, Netflix for a year is a really great thing, especially for someone who's struggling and wants a nice little thing in their lives. Netflix provides a lot of that, or a place like Hulu whatsoever. And we've had another site that we just came across that did a great job of breaking down all of the different streaming sites, so you can punch in whatever channel you want, whether it's HBO or ABC or ESPN, and it'll tell you which streaming service offers that. And it's at recode.net, but we'll have a direct link to that at onyourmoney.com later on today.
And what if you find yourself in the position of having more time than money?
The opposite side of it. Well, give a little bit of that time and maybe some expertise. You know, give a certificate to say, hey, you name the time and date. If I'm available, we'll come over and I'll clean out your garage for you. I'll help you get your basement or your closets put back together again, or your kitchen maybe if it needs some work, or you need some help just getting junk out of the house, I'll do that. Or this is something that I've done in the past. You know, if someone's driving an older car, you know, there's not much you can do. You can't buy them a new car unless you're Elvis, but you can clean their car for them. You can take it to the car wash. You can wash it. You can vacuum it all out. You can shine up everything up. And yeah, it might take $10 or $20 worth of money to actually use the vacuum and all that and get the car wash for it. But the people will really appreciate that and enjoy how much better their car looks. If you're younger and you're going home for the holidays, there's a pretty good chance that the older people in your family are not as tech savvy as you are. So you might want to say, Dad, let me go through your computer and I'll update everything on there. I'll put in some antivirus stuff on there and I'll clean up your Outlook email box or whatever. Or give me your phone and I'll make that work better for you, because chances are you know how to do it as well. This is something I've known a couple people who've done this in the past, where they've said, hey, my grandmother had a lot of pictures, and so what I did is I digitized all the pictures, scanned them all in, and then the best ones I put in a book. And you can go to a service like groovebook.com, 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 and that will help you print all of those pictures that you've chosen in a particular book, and then you can make copies and give them out to other family members as well. And as finally, if you're financially savvy and you have a friend or family member who's not, help them with their taxes, or if they're older, maybe their Medicare enrollment, or we're going to talk about this next week during the On Your Money membership drive on we're going to be giving away 15 ways to fight fraud to people who pledge at any dollar amount. You might want to say, hey, Grandma, can I freeze your credit report? And she may have already done it, but she may not know how to do it, or she may not even know what a credit report is and why she should freeze it. Finally, spend some time with an older person. Take her out to lunch. Take her to see some friends. Take her to see the doctor, and she'll really appreciate that time. All you need to do is give up an hour or two of your time and listen to some good stories.
Well, let's go back to the phones now with John in Janesville. Hi, John.
Good morning, all. Thank you for taking my call. I was born in January of 47, so that makes me 7 years old, and I have some required minimum distribution coming due. My question is, coming due this year, by the first of the year, as I know. My question is, how do I know that when I do my required minimum distribution, I'm sure that my advisor is going to want to move them into different plans here and there. He's talked in the past about ETFs and different stuff like that. How do I know that upon the removal of these instruments, how do I know that I'm going to be paying the least amount of fees and charges and et cetera?
Have you ever asked your advisor, John, how he's getting paid?
No, I haven't, but I have asked him about if he is a fiduciary, and he has.
Okay, he says he's a fiduciary.
Yes, and in listening to many radio call-in programs dealing with financial problems, I heard one time that they should be sending me an ADV form.
Yep.
To the best of my knowledge, I've never received one.
Yeah, you should receive one. It could be buried in a bunch of paperwork, but you should definitely receive one. But it's just a fair question to ask John and say, hey, you know, before I do this, what is this going to cost me, and how do you get paid? And I don't need an ADV form to tell me that. I want you to tell it to me. You know, you still want to get the ADV form, but that's buried on page 72 in legalese. You know, you want to have something that's clear and concise and that you can understand. And he should be able to very clearly say, well, what happens is we bill your account X percent a year. Let's say it's 1%. And as you can see, we deducted this dollar amount. We deducted $250 last quarter. That's the fee that I get paid for all the stuff that I do. I don't get paid by anybody else. Or he'll say, yeah, you actually get paid a commission every time I make the sale, and here's how much commission. And it should be readily transparent. And if not, you should ask him. And if he doesn't give you an answer, or doesn't give you an answer that's easy to understand and comprehend, you should look for another financial advisor, because no one is doing this for free. They are charging you and making money some way or another. And that's okay that they're making money. You just want to know how they're getting paid and what that dollar amount is.
John, thanks so much for calling in. Let's go to Bob, who joins us from Cedarburg. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. And Kevin, I must say that your program is of most interest to the average consumer, and it's very helpful, especially to the majority of the people listening.
Thank you, Bob. That means a lot to me, so I really appreciate you saying that. Thank you.
My question is, I'm 73 years old. I'm retired. We're debt-free. We have about $120,000 annual income, of which $65,000 is fixed income. So when our RMDs come out every year, I just reinvest them. With that said, we're about 60% in stock, 40% in bonds, and here I am, 73 years old, fighting that old adage about subtracting your age from the 100. And the reason I'm concerned is that maybe I'm foolishly leaving too much risk out there. And your thoughts?
I'm a big fan of rules of thumb. That's one that I don't like to use because every person's situation is different, and just predicating it on age is not my favorite way to think about asset allocation. It depends on how much growth you need, how much risk you can stand. A lot of times, Bob, people in your situation, I would guess this is the case, they realize they have more than enough money than they could possibly use up, and therefore they're taking risks to get return that they don't really need. And again, that's okay too if you're okay with it dropping in value while you try to achieve the risk. But for some people, it's kind of like, you know, you're driving home from, let's say, the supermarket. You're three blocks from your house, and you're going down a residential street, and you don't see anybody, and you don't see any police officers. So you figure, you know what, I'm just going to drive 90 miles an hour so that I can get to my destination 30 seconds sooner. It might work out just fine, and you might get there 30 seconds sooner, but why would you take that tremendous risk when you're in no hurry, there's no deadline to get home, and risk, you know, getting in a crash, hitting some little kid crossing, or even just getting a speeding ticket? So it's the same thing with investing in stocks when you're already financially secure. You're taking on risks that you don't necessarily need because you don't need the return. On the other hand, you can say, hey, I've got $1 million. If it drops to $500,000, I won't be happy about it, but I'm still not, my lifestyle is not going to be changed. Therefore, I can take that kind of risk. So whatever you have in the stock market, run through kind of a fire drill, Bob, where you look at it and say, if this were to drop 30 or 40 or 50%, how would I feel? And if it would hurt you, then you should be less exposed to stocks and investments that can drop by that much and scale back to the point where you where you're more comfortable. And especially, it sounds like if you're on a fixed income and your income is that high, you're probably have a pension check coming in. And that pension is likely invested in stocks and bonds as well. And so if stocks drop, that pension is made less secure. And therefore, you may be taking on even more risk than you actually know.
Bob, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Greg in Milwaukee. Hi, Greg.
Hi, thank you very much. I had a IRA rollover account, self-directed, parked in it with a large firm in Milwaukee. And recently they have said that their fiduciary duties or something along those lines required them to distribute that because they no longer want that fiduciary duty under Labor Department rules, which have recently changed. So I got a check and they withheld like $4,000 in taxes. Is this what's going on here?
Was it an IRA?
It was a rollover IRA.
Rollover IRA. Okay, yeah, that's really strange. Did they just send it to you, Greg? But or was it something that happened a while ago?
No, they just sent it to me.
Okay. There's a good chance that you can take that check and go put it into an IRA. And for expediency, what I would do is just go to your bank or credit union, open up an IRA there like a CD and redeposit it back there. And then if at a certain point you can refile to get the taxes withheld because you didn't want this money taken out, correct?
Made 21% plus during the year, and they wanted me to transfer it to their bundled investments.
Right.
We're making 6%.
Okay. Yeah, I'd contact the firm. I mean, and makes is not the correct term. It's has made. It's past tense. We don't know if it's going to be making 6% or going to be making 21% or going to be losing in the future. That's irrelevant for this discussion. I'd contact the firm and say, hey, why did you do this and what are my options? But I'd also get the money into an IRA. And from my understanding of the way you've phrased this and the way the context is that you should be able to get the taxes back if you can get the money back into a qualified retirement account. And I think it's usually 60 days is the window that you can use. But contact the firm that spit the money out and find out why it happened and what your options otherwise would be. And then if you have a tax person, some CPA, contact the CPA and see if to make sure you get it moved over in a qualified manner as well.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8 and rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. This hour was produced by Bill Martins with technical direction from executive producer Michelle Johnson. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.